This is the Freshman 15.
This is Daniel Long, and I need me some of the sweet blood of Jesus.
And I am definitely not Malcolm X.
So, Jeremy, here we are.
Here we are, man. Have we had any listener mail, feedback, anything like that recently?
Okay, so we did have some in response, of course, to our last episode.
Sure, James Cameron.
James Cameron. This note is from our friend Diana.
And by the way, I want to point this out. Diana has been a listener from episode one.
She is faithful.
She's one of our most faithful listeners. So
Diana,
thank
you're
you.
The best. Thank you so much. All right. So this is what she says. So in answer to your question mid-podcast, last time I saw Terminator, about a month ago, still love it. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm 7.
Okay. All right. All right. So I know we had a whole thing, and I was definitely leading the charge of anti-James Cameron for the majority of the episode.
I think that's true.
There's a little shift toward the end there where I was...
You came around.
Well, here's the thing.
I've not came around, because I mean, I wasn't...
Around.
Oh, rah, 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 right?
No.
Don't do that to me.
But you were a Terminator guy.
Yeah,
still are.
Sure.
So, and just a little peek behind the scenes of how we do this. Daniel and I, we get together, we record the podcast... Then the podcast goes into what I call post-production, which is we edit it all down, we get it to roughly an hour, and we also go around and we find clips and, you know, we put in the necessary music and all that kind of thing. So what I have to then do is I listen back through our conversation and I find clips that are appropriate to what you and I, Daniel, have talked about, and I insert it. So we had a lot of little comments about Terminator, so, you know, I went back through and didn't watch all of it, but I wound up watching a hefty little chunk of the Terminator movies.
And
I'm not changing my opinion, but I will concede that, you know what, I did get it a little bit more.
Okay.
I'm not going to say, come around to saying the script is great or anything like that, but...
You found something there.
I'll concede, maybe. I was a little hard on James Cameron.
Right. Well, okay. Maybe let's talk about you were a little hard in reference to those films.
Yeah.
Because I think your main comment about those films was you just didn't get it, right? You kind of missed out on that whole window of maybe when that was popular or what people enjoyed about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what you're telling me now is that you're completely turned around. you love them. You're going to watch the whole franchise of Terminator.
Yeah, Terminator 19, the age of John Connor, whatever. I don't know what they're called anymore, but I was able to sort of momentarily transport myself back to the 80s and 90s and just be like, I can see how this did really well. Now, granted, I was pulling clips from the infamous second half of the James Cameron films, which we've all acknowledged this is definitely the better half.
Yeah.
So if I were to watch these things end to end again, maybe I'd feel, yeah, whatever. But to Diana's point, I don't blame you for being into Terminator. And by the way, Diana is a personal friend of mine. We've had debates, and I mean debates about James Cameron.
No.
Either way, and, you know, I would say to Diana, thank you for listening.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your comments. Very, very kind. All right, you know what? I feel like, and for reasons that are going to quickly become apparent, I think we're kind of stalling a little bit.
No,
so.
I'm not.
No?
I feel like you're stalling.
I might be beating around the bush a little more than usual here. We need to put an end to this. Let's just get to it. What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right.
What about Nola Dawn? What do you want to know? I thought she was a freak. You know, freaky dicky. You asked why did I continue to see her? To look like a retard? I'm not crazy. The sex was death. Nola had the goods and she knew what to do. Look, all men want freaks. We just don't want them for a wife.
Daniel.
Yep.
Let's you and me make a handshake deal this time around.
Okay.
I'm going to acknowledge, I hope you'll acknowledge, we're a white guy talking to a mostly white guy.
Yeah, I'm mostly white. You're right. Half Mexican.
You're half Mexican, but I feel like in spirit, you've got more.
I've got more whiteness.
You've got a white guy attitude.
Yeah, it's true. I've got a white guy attitude. I don't know what that means, but I think I have it.
You know it when you see it. We're going to be getting into some opinions and some topics in areas that, let's just acknowledge it right now, we're probably not fully qualified to get into, right?
We're definitely not. I mean, I was thinking about a lot of that coming into this episode. What does it mean for us? I mean, for you, really, as someone who's mostly white, to talk about a director of color.
Yeah. I mean, I think back to a little over a year ago at this point, it was important to us to get into, for example, our Sofia Coppola episode, because we're like, you know, this is a bunch of white guys that we've been talking about up to now. I look back at that episode, it wound up being one of our most rewarding episodes for me personally.
Right. I enjoyed the conversation.
Hopefully for the audience also. Daniel, you and I have been talking about doing a Spike Lee episode for quite a while now. And, you know, maybe like James Cameron, I was definitely a holdout on that because I've just been straight up scared to do this episode.
So you've been scared to talk about.
Yeah, because I don't feel qualified to talk about the films of Spike Lee, because you can't talk about the films of Spike Lee without talking about the issues that are underneath the films of Spike Lee.
I know we're going to get into the film and we're going to talk about that. But I think you're raising some good points that we kind of just need to hash out right now. What qualifies a person to be able to talk about these types of films? Is the qualification solely that we would be people of color talking about films that primarily concern people of color? Is that, I mean, what, how, right. is that kind of what you're feeling the tension about?
Yeah, maybe. But I think maybe, and this is part of what I wanted to say. I wanted to make a deal with you that we're not going to posture like we have expertise in these areas, but yet we sit here behind these microphones. We talk about films because we love films and we're interested in them. They're tangentially related to my occupation, I guess, kind of, but if we're looking for qualifications to why we should even be talking about films at all, we'll just go crazy.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that same sort of thing applies here. No, you know, we're not quote unquote qualified. Well, whatever. We want to talk about these films anyways, because I don't know, they're interesting. They're important films to talk about. Spike Lee's an interesting guy. I'll admit up front, I haven't seen the majority of Spike Lee movies, partly because his library is just so enormous. But, you know, maybe there's other reasons, too, that we can get into. I say we make a deal that's not going to stop us from talking about how we feel and how we're affected by what we see and what we see in the world around us. We're just going to allow ourselves that latitude.
I'm right there with you. Let's make a deal.
All right. So the freshman film of Spike Lee, 1986, and of course that film is a mostly, but not fully, but mostly black and white film on a low budget, no budget, called She's Gotta Have It. So Daniel, my first question to you, before we get into the full discussion, who is she and what is it?
All right, so
that's my throw to you as a premise setup.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really great question, because that's one of my questions that I was going to pose to you. So I'll get to an answer by way of a premise. All right?
Let's have it.
So She's Gotta Have It concerns the main character of Nola Darling. She's a woman in Brooklyn, New York. She's free with her sexuality, polyamorous. She has three male suitors, if you will.
Right.
Three guys who love her, who make love to her, but all want her to commit to them.
Right.
And these three suitors are very different. I mean, you have like the straight kind of nice guy.
Yeah, the audience stand-in almost.
Yeah, absolutely. You have this wacky guy who is just totally lucky to be with Nola in the first place.
Right.
Then you have this GQ model who lifts weights.
Right.
I mean, so you have these three characters who couldn't be more different, and they all love Nola. They all want Nola.
Right.
But what Nola wants is choice, right? Freedom. If she's got to have anything, she's got to have what she wants, and I think she doesn't want to be confined necessarily to one of those three men.
Right.
What do you think about that answer?
Yeah, it's probably deeper and more honest than what my answer would be. Because I think at the surface level, she also just wants, as the kids call it, the D.
She wants to bone.
And you know what, man? A lot of the movie is about this sort of, you know, I don't know, I guess an insensitive way or a sexist way to put it would be to call her like a nymphomaniac or something like that. But she's clearly sex obsessed, at least as much as these three guys are, I would say.
If not more, right?
If not more.
Yeah.
And that's sort of set up for everything that we see in the rest of the movie. And I would even go so far as to say it's not just these three guys that she's addicted to having sexual relationships with, but these are the three that we're kind of concentrating on, right?
Absolutely. So let's put this movie in context. So this is 1986. Here we have a film that portrays the lives of black people, and in particular, a woman who is very free with her sexuality.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something that's controversial, but it's certainly something that's progressive,
yeah.
Displaying a concept or a character that the public may not know what to do with, right?
Yeah. Because it's also even getting into issues like, you know, the fluidity of sexuality, because, you know, there's things that are hinted at or outright said or even outright shown that demonstrate that this isn't just about heterosexual relationships either.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that what I love about Spike Lee as a filmmaker is shown right here immediately. And in this film is, here's a guy who's not afraid to put something on screen to get people talking or to get people up in arms about.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's kind of his reason in life.
You think that's his purpose, his pursuit as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, honestly, I think that I would compare personally Spike Lee to kind of maybe even like an Oliver Stone or something like there. He's there to provoke, to needle the society around him into a discussion that they probably assume that they're not ready to have. But I don't know. I see Spike Lee behind the camera saying, well, you might not be ready, but you're about to have this discussion.
Huh. Yeah, I think that that's true. So kind of given that and given Spike Lee's place in cinema, at least kind of as somebody who's provocative, I'm curious to know what your first experience with Spike Lee was.
With Spike Lee.
Yeah, just as a filmmaker, I'm assuming this was actually the first time you'd seen this film.
Yeah, this is the first time I'd seen She's Gotta Have It.
Because he actually just remade She's Gotta Have It as a Netflix show.
Which I want to get into that in a minute. But my first exposure, though, to Spike Lee, the first film, you know, I worked with a really talented designer when I was fresh out of school. Like I said, I always call it my film awakening period, where I was trying to take in as much as possible. And a designer that I worked with, named Brian Brinkman, he said, drop everything you have to see before you see anything else. Do the Right Thing.
Okay.
Which he cited as one of his favorite movies of all time. By the way, Brian's a white guy. And all right, rented it. Was not sure what I thought, but I knew that I was legitimately blown away. I didn't know if it was blown away because it was so good, or that it was because it was so difficult, or if it was just a mishmash of all these things, or I didn't know what it was, but it invaded every single fold of my brain. I was like, holy cow, this movie is kind of messing with me. You know,
interesting, right?
On all the different sensory levels, you know, it just getting across the way he was using color,
right,
and language, not giving us anything that was easy, and nothing in a film that is almost made in a certain way that it almost kind of feels a lot of it like a laugh or something. But then you get to the end of it, and it is not a laugh at the end there.
You and me, same. We same.
Same, be black. Open your eyes, motherfucker. Leave the Korean alone, man. He's all right. Yeah, he's all right. He's black.
It was almost overload for me. I was like, this is way more than I wanted to get into.
Interesting, right.
Of course, my first exposure to Spike Lee at all has to be his old Air Jordan commercials from, I don't know if it was late 80s or early 90s, but this is embarrassing. I didn't even realize until a couple weeks ago when I first saw She's Gotta Have It that Mars Blackman
came from this.
Yeah, originated with this movie. Spike Lee's character, Mars Blackmon, appeared in a series of commercials with Michael Jordan to sell Nike basketball sneakers, specifically Air Jordans, and they were such creative commercials. I remember my dad loved them, and he would quote them all the time.
That's so good.
Marty, is it the shoes? Is it the shoes? Gotta be the shoes.
Yo, Mars Blackmon here with my main man, Michael Jordan. Yo, Mike, what makes you the best player in the universe? Is it the vicious stunts?
No, Mars.
Is it the haircut?
No, Mars.
Is it the shoes?
No, Mars.
Is it the extra long shorts?
No, Mars.
It's the shoes then, right?
Nah.
Even when I would ask your dad. Yeah, my dad. I would ask my dad, Dad, can I have my allowance? And he would shake his head at me and go, no. And then he would start laughing. And I realized he's quoting Mars Blackmon talking about the shoes. Anyhow.
That's actually really beautiful, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that this character has kind of transcended color.
Yeah. For all of Spike Lee's accomplishments, he's always going to be Mars Blackmon to me.
Okay, so there's a funny story that I read about that. So the way he got that gig was obviously from She's Gotta Have It.
Yeah.
But so some execs saw the preview of She's Gotta Have It, and we're like, man, this character's so interesting.
Yeah.
We got to go see this film.
And obsessed with his shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. So they went to go see this movie, and then they were watching it, and there's a moment in the film when Mars Blackmon is making love to Nola Darling.
Yeah.
It's kind of a shot that just shows the feet, and it's clear that he hasn't taken off his shoes
right.
in order to make love to Nola. And they were thinking, that's perfect. Like, here's a guy who won't even take off his shoes, his yeah. Air Jordans,
right.
to make love to a woman.
Yeah.
This is the guy we need. Like, which is, I think, is such an incredible, like, and that's how he got the gig.
Yeah, I don't think we've said it out loud, but just so the audience knows, Mars Blackmon, Spike Lee plays that part, not in just those commercials, but also in, of course, She's Gotta Have It. And that's only changed recently, and you know, that there's a new Mars Blackmon now, but that's a whole other story.
Oh, right, from the Netflix show.
Right.
Okay. When I first heard of Spike Lee, I had a friend who was black who lived on my street. This was pre-high school and probably middle school. And he was talking to me about having seen a film that was really, like, it seemed important to his family, and it was Malcolm X. And
right.
and I think that came out in 1992. So it was sometime around, so I was probably like 10 or 11. That's when I'd heard about Spike Lee. I didn't see Malcolm X at the time, but I'd heard of this name, Spike Lee.
Right.
And the first film I'd actually seen of his was a documentary in high school called Four Little Girls, which is about the bombing of a church during the civil rights movement.
Right.
And I can't remember which one I'd seen after that, but I'd seen maybe one or two after that. And then I saw 25th Hour.
Right.
That really made an impression on me. And then maybe a year later, I saw She's Gotta Have It in a class in college.
Yeah.
So Spike Lee had kind of become this figure in my mind of this filmmaker who makes these really interesting movies. I mean, from what I'd heard, Malcolm X, right, to a documentary, to a story about this white guy in New York,
mm-hmm.
to now his freshman film being this movie about a woman
right.
who's like sexually liberated. He was such an interesting figure
yeah.
to me as a filmmaker.
It's interesting because, you know, the format, of course, that we're talking about, this is the podcast. The first podcast that I ever heard, and it was still a brand new concept, was actually a podcast about and by Spike Lee.
No.
That's true.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So I have this kind of strange sort of podcast nostalgia. Podcasts were brand new, and Spike Lee decided to make a podcast. It was a multi-episode thing.
Wow.
About his experience making the film Inside Man.
Oh, cool.
It was some of the most intimate access I had ever experienced. He just basically, as he directed the film, he wore a mic.
No.
Yeah. And he went around and, you know, he was just, you know, talking to like Clive Owen and Denzel and just talking about the experiences of, I mean, it wasn't always turned on, but he would turn it on for certain, you know, whatever meetings that he would take or something. And he would also just kind of narrate into the mic like, oh, this is what I'm doing right now. And I'm going over to talk to Clive Owen. And you hear Clive Owen being like, oh, hey, Spike, yeah, I'm just working on lines or something. It was intimate in a way that DVD extras weren't.
Wow.
You know, it was just the straight mainline access right into Spike Lee's process. It was so super cool.
That is cool.
I don't even, I looked for it the other day. I don't even know if it's still available anywhere online. I don't see it anywhere. If you're a listener and, you know, you want to try and find it, and you do successfully, please let me know because I'd love to hear it again. But yeah, the Spike Lee Inside Man podcast was my first exposure to podcasts.
I think you're bringing up something that I love about Spike Lee. So he has this story about, he went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. So I guess he was born in Atlanta and then moved to Brooklyn. And that's where he grew up. Then he went back to Atlanta to go to college. And he said that his first experience in making a film, I think it was the summer of, I can't remember, 76, 77.
Right.
And there was this blackout that happened kind of around him. And he's like, oh, this is really interesting. I'm going to take a camera and I'm going to film kind of what's going on.
Now I had a Super 8 camera,
yeah,
a box of Super 8 cartridges, mm-hmm. and I had something to do. So that summer, I spent the whole summer running around filming stuff around New York City. So Morehouse didn't have that major, but Clark College did, which is across the street. So as a teacher who still teaches there today, his name is Dr. Herb Eichelberger. He's the one that encouraged me to say, Spike, because I said, I got all this footage. He says, why make this into a film? So I cut it together as a documentary. It's called Last Hustle Brooklyn. Everything I filmed, I ended up doing many years later in Summer Sale. It's the same movie.
That connects to what you are describing. These events and these moments, or this technology, or this form that he's going to kind of take advantage of to do something with and to tell a story. I feel like that's quintessential Spike Lee, finding opportunities to tell stories.
Right.
I see that here all the way at the beginning with She's Gotta Have It, telling this unique story that hasn't been told before, at least with these types of people.
Yeah.
It's just going for it.
I had an experience a couple of years ago where I was in a show a couple of years ago, A Raisin in the Sun.
Which was awesome.
Thank you.
I was there. It was amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Only white guy in the cast. Pretty clearly the villain of the story. Happy to do it. Happy to serve a story that's that good. Mm-hmm. Lorraine Hansberry wrote such a beautiful play, such a nuanced play. A play that was, at the time, the first exposure anyone had ever had, certainly for white audiences, of a story that had different types of nuanced characters that were African-American. There was basically just a general African-American character that found its way into every movie and every play.
Yeah.
But this was showing there are different types of personalities and levels. I think that in some ways, Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It is a close cousin to that, mm-hmm. because there's such a diversity of personality types and people types and character types and relationship types, all told within this African-American community. Quite frankly, every character is not just flawed, but deeply flawed, mm-hmm. in sometimes serious ways, sometimes comical ways, sometimes wince-inducing ways.
Yes.
For this movie to make such a mark, you know, it went on to Cannes and won a handful of awards. And this was a real kind of moment. Mm-hmm. And honestly, before doing some of the research into She's Gotta Have It over the last couple of weeks, I never realized that, what a mark and what an accomplishment this was.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it was filmed for just over $150,000 over the course of...
It's like 3 weeks or something, right?
Yeah, it was. It's in a really condensed amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But then also to kind of recoup,
yeah,
the cost of, even, I mean, like insurmountable in his recoup, but also just in the accolades and kind of what he received in terms of being a filmmaker and the type of story he told.
Yeah. Rather than talking exclusively about the environment and the personalities around She's Gotta Have It, what is this movie? I mean, it's so many ways. There's so many new things, certainly at the time, new things that were going on, things that would become Spike Lee staples later, a lot of these techniques. Yeah. I don't know how else to put it. What do you think of this movie?
No, absolutely. The way into Spike Lee often seems to be the ideas and the content, right? Rather than the craft and the style.
Mm-hmm.
And we just did that. I mean, we just happened to do that. And I think that's kind of like an indicative of what a Spike Lee film does.
A Spike Lee
joint, good call, is it kind of provokes these conversations. But thinking about this movie, what is this movie? Is it a, yeah. I mean, is it? It's comedic. It's,
yeah, sort of.
But it's also tragic.
Yeah, I mean, it's comedic, but not really funny.
No.
I don't know. It's certainly not a tearjerker. It draws you in to this sort of intimacy, but also keeps you way at arm's length in a lot of ways. it's not only not afraid to break that fourth wall.
Oh, yeah.
The whole style of the movie relies on it.
It does.
In fact, I would go so far as to say that, I mean, I wouldn't say half, but a significant percentage of this film is with no fourth wall at all. It's characters addressing us as an audience into camera.
I want you to know the only reason I'm consenting to this is because I wish to clear my name. Not that I care what people think, but enough is enough. And if in the end it helps some other people out, well, then that's fine, too. I consider myself normal, whatever that means. Some people call me a freak. I hate that word. I don't believe in it. Better yet, I don't believe in labels. But what are you going to do? This was the deal.
It's not a device as much as it is the story.
Yeah.
Which makes you kind of wonder, where am I in this, right, as the viewer or the kid? It's not a mockumentary.
Yeah.
But then you kind of feel like, consistently wonder what you're supposed to think of that.
Yeah, and any semblance of, I mean, I guess you could call it a story. There is a story, technically. It's putting these characters essentially on the psychiatry couch.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Where are you? Who are you? What are you experiencing? What kind of comment do you have about the society around you? I would say it's a less than mature take on society and different personality types. Spike Lee's clearly a young guy with a young guy's perspective on it. And you get the impression sometimes that he hasn't lived a lot of life yet.
It's true.
But then there are these moments where you're like, wow, sometimes it's just a stylistic flourish or something like that. Or maybe it's like the edge of a certain comment or something that one of the characters is making. I never quite knew what level this movie was at. And I also never quite figured out if that was fully intentional or not. I mean, maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'm with you there, because you have a filmmaker who's willing, and a writer who's willing to put on display a really strong female character who, again, is not willing to live within the confines of what society says female sexuality should be.
Right.
So it seems in that way that Spike Lee would be progressive in terms of his view of femininity.
Yeah.
But then he's also just a dude who's making a film about men having sex with this woman.
Right.
Those, some of those scenes that are, I would say, are really stylistically interesting, filmed in really remarkable ways in terms of it being his first film. Mm. I'm still very aware of the fact that this is a guy.
Yeah.
Really interesting tension there. Where you can be both really progressive on one end, and yet the same way seem pretty immature in your perspective of how you're doing that.
Right. I mean, you know, sex is such a huge component in this movie. It's, in fact, to call it a component is to undersell it. It's just, it's central.
It's the force.
Yeah. There's a part of me that's thinking, okay, Spike Lee, he wrote the script. He's directing these actors. And, you know, I'm thinking specifically of a scene, the sex scene between Mars Blackman, played by Spike Lee, and Nola Darling. That just the idea of imagining the conversation and the table read and the rehearsals and all that, where he's just like, it's actually a really important cultural thing. So right. I just, but don't sweat it. We're going to light it in this really cool way. And I'm just thinking about how lousy that conversation probably was. It would be for me, put it right. That way. I wouldn't want to have that conversation with an actress. But I'm just looking at it and just thinking, I mean, what can you say? He's committed to this thing. But as a young guy, was there a side of it where he was just kind of like, I don't know, I think about sex all the time. Maybe I also just kind of want to make a movie that sex is a central component, because yeah, that's where my brain is at. There were things in it that were, I would say, less than stellar, you know?
Absolutely.
The performances, I would not say are great performances, really any of them. I don't think any one performance in it is a great performance. No. I struggled with the script.
Mm-hmm.
There would be times that I didn't know whether or not this is a very stylized script, or other times I'd be like, I think that's just bad though.
Yeah.
You know, is that style or is that bad?
I'll be damned if she takes Mars from me. I'm 4 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm. The decent black men are all taken. The rest are in prison or homos.
I've gone to bed alone too much already. I'm from Brownsville. We don't play that shit.
So what should we do to her?
If you hear me like coming to a conclusion on what I eventually think about that, then that's unintentional, because I still don't know whether right. some of these script elements are bad or or if it's just very deliberately styled. I realize that's all over the place, but these are all just these floating aspects that I'm still just trying to grab a hold of. I don't know what I think.
I think all the things that you mentioned are important aspects. In terms of the Morris Blackman character,
yeah,
I did read that was intended for another actor.
Really?
Who ended up bailing a few days before the shoot started because he got a quote-unquote real job. This is the story that the cinematographer tells, not Spike Lee himself. I wonder how that plays into it. But you're right in terms of the script. There were times I'm like, I don't really know if you, Spike, are aware of what you're doing and why.
Mm.
We'll constantly go back to our very first episode with the Coen brothers because that was a freshman film that felt so completely realized and nothing like a freshman film. This, to me, feels like somebody's freshman film.
Yeah, right? Yeah, 100%. A very intelligent and a very specific voice freshman film, but so unpolished.
Yeah, it feels like it's the beginning of an artist you want to follow and watch, but right. Not the beginning of an artist that's fully realized
yeah.
yet, right? And I think that when I was watching this film again, those are the moments that I kept on coming back to. It's like, I don't think he would do that again. Or I don't know if this was intentional. I mean, even some, I'm thinking specifically of the Thanksgiving scene around the table where I feel like already the camera's in a bizarre place because it seems as if it should be from the perspective of Nola, but yet it's elevated to a level that is confusing.
Yeah.
So you're seeing it almost from this higher level, the three suitors are around the table with Nola. Some of that, the conversation is actually pretty humorous.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's clear that Spike Lee can't hold it together. I mean, he's almost laughing.
Yeah.
This is the first Thanksgiving I've ever cooked.
The first?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first.
What would you like? White meat or dark meat?
Man, give me the dark. Give me some more meat, man. That's a baby.
I'll give you more later, Morris.
Yeah? White, please.
Figures.
There's the constraint of money, right? If you had more money, maybe you'd shoot more takes.
Right.
But it felt like that scene in particular, and other scenes, but that scene for sure, I think back, that was a freshman film scene. That was a student film scene almost.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I see that. I see that kind of thing all through it. I see the fuck-ups when I see Nola in her fourth wall moments, and she's... It looks like her eye line keeps going just below the camera. And honestly, it looks like she's reading some of her lines.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and there's little things like that, not just with her. And kind of like you mentioned, you see a little half flubs and that kind of stuff with Spike Lee himself. You can tell.
Yeah.
It's just like, no, that's something that you left in. That's
right.
You know, almost clerk style.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, I mean, you mentioned something earlier, and I think it was within the conversation about his immaturity as an artist and a limited perspective. And it made me think of, I recently read this wonderful essay actually about the novel Jane Eyre. And the title of the essay was called Degrees of Wokeness in Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
The main thesis is, for all that Jane Eyre does in terms of presenting a strong female character, it seems completely blind to its references to colonialism and slavery, right? It's so entrenched in the culture that it can't help but be blind to that while at the same time doing something really important for the female voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about that in terms of this film. I couldn't stop thinking about that, where here you have a really important film talking about a really strong woman, while at the same time, it seems really limited in terms of its approach to sexuality, in terms of how men view sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it just feels sometimes blind to the power that men have over women that I think this film takes for granted.
Yeah, this film, as I was saying before, it's challenging and provoking. There's conventional wisdom about what the sexual relationship is between men and women, what the position and the types of personalities that are going to do well versus not do well in the African-American community. Again, this is where we're getting into
right.
areas that I'm probably talking out of my ass, but whatever, I'm just going to keep talking.
Go for it. We've made a deal.
Made a deal, though. I feel like this is Spike Lee's flair that he's sending up and saying, I want you to question all those things.
Yeah.
It's all fair game here. It's all up for grabs. even by virtue of the fact that the film, every introduction of every character opens with a fourth wall breaking monologue. This is Spike Lee saying, if you have rules in your brain coming into this, you're going to have a bad time.
Leave them at the door.
You have to leave them out. Yeah, it's just it's the only way that I'm even going to allow you to engage with this. Yeah, the fact that he did this whole thing for no money and all that, it all points back to the fact that he clearly had something that he felt like, however rough and unpolished it was, and however young and immature and dumb he was, mm-hmm. you know, at the time, he still had terrific conviction about what it was that he was saying and the way that he was trying to say it. You know, it was really interesting, too, because the scenes that I think in most movies I would be comfortable with, mm-hmm. I wasn't comfortable. And scenes that in other movies I would be uncomfortable with, I found that were maybe sometimes the easiest to watch. Specifically, and I want to know what you think about this, too. I think my favorite parts of the film were actually the sex scenes.
Interesting.
I've never felt that way about a movie I've ever seen before.
So you appreciated those.
I appreciated. I could tell you were about to say I enjoyed it. I enjoyed them. Okay. Yes, I enjoyed the sex scenes. But there was something about these scenes. I don't know. It was a different sort of eroticism, I guess, if you want to call it that. Yeah, there's nudity and there wasn't any ambiguity about what's going on. But I don't know how he did it. He did it in such a way where, you know, there's some movies that treat this kind of thing really pornographically.
Right.
Clearly, the whole reason that the scene is there is to try and, you know,
titillate.
Yeah, try and turn us on. You know, there's other types of movies where it's just trying to hint at something, and they, you know, and you can tell they kind of try and get through it as fast as possible and so that they can move on with the story because they know audiences are kind of squirming if they happen to be there with their sister-in-law or something like mm-hmm. that. But this movie did something different. It did something where it let us see how intimate and also funny and also awkward and beautiful and all these different things all going on at once that sex can be.
Interesting.
And I don't know that I've ever seen quite that in any other movie before. And I was really, really intrigued by it. It didn't really feel like Spike Lee was trying to turn me on. It felt like he was trying to say something about these relationships through these flawed and in some cases just super shallow people, you right. know, in a lot of ways. But I don't know, it's lit in such a way and it's edited in such a way and all that, that I just thought, am I going to let myself... When I allowed myself to just enjoy the scenes, it was a rewarding scene. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess, whatever. I'm not going to be ashamed to say that. I enjoyed watching those scenes. I thought they were really nicely done.
The first time I'd seen this film was probably 15 years ago, and it was in class. And so going back to this film, I just had no remembrance of these sex scenes.
Like you'd blacked it out?
It wasn't so much a blackout. It was just like what kind of stood out most in my mind in memory of this film were the characters talking to the camera and it being in black and white and it being unpolished. Like those were probably the three things that I held on to in watching this film as a young person who was really interested in film and, oh man, what would it be like to make your own film, right? And so watching this movie again, I felt kind of uncomfortable by them because they caught me off guard. But I agree with you completely in that they were filmed in such a way that I was supposed to pay attention. That's one of the things that I found really interesting about this movie is not even in terms of sex, but when they were in Nola's room, specifically where the bed was, I think that was some of the best filmmaking in the whole film.
Right.
It's when I felt like Spike knew how to use the camera in a really profound way. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of a shot. I think it's Jamie and Nola, but I just know that they're sitting on the bed and the camera begins in this close-up shot, profile shot of their face, and it tracks around them and it becomes almost like this wider establishing shot. It really highlights the conversation that they're having about commitment and about, you know, who's... And I just thought that shot seems really confident,
right?
You know, and there were so many of those in that setting near her bed that I just felt like, wow, Spike knows what he's doing. Yeah. I think one of the most funny shots is when Nola is wanting to have sex with Greer Giles, and she's in bed, she's ready, and Greer is just taking his time, taking off his clothing, folding them.
Right.
And it keeps cutting back to Nola, cutting back to Greer. That was so funny.
Yeah.
And played so well. I don't know why, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this,
mm-hmm.
is why that area of the film, Nola's bedroom, is the place where I feel like Spike was the filmmaker that he will end up becoming.
Hmm. Well, especially with the sex scenes, but even just like the pre and post coital scenes.
Pre and post coital.
Here's the whatever, the practical.
Yeah, this is what I want to know.
You know, this is the practical part of it, and just thinking about it in terms of, okay, here's how much time and here's how much budget. He probably had the most control over that set.
Okay.
In terms of lighting and all that. And that's why I think so much of the lighting and some of these scenes is so dynamic, where, you know, you go into some of these other locations and it's, you know, I'm not saying the lighting's bad, but it's flatter and all that. But, you know, you go into that bedroom and there's magic in there.
He can do what he wants.
In fact, I think that's even something that they allude to in the dialogue. It's just, you know, this is where the magic is. He had full art direction, you know, ability. We were talking about, like, you know, David Lynch, who spent the time that he needed because it was a very closed set in the spot in Henry's room. I think it might have been a similar thing here, and Spike may have even worked it into the dialogue of the scene about just talking about, like, the mystique and the magic of this bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm sure there's probably better, more poetic reasons to get into that. It's hard for me to think past just the practicalities of it.
I think that's really important, though. So those scenes in the bedroom, I find the most, for me, clear threads
right
throughout the body of his work. But especially in these scenes, you have the camera that's moving. I mean, he loves a moving camera. I think it's really fascinating to get the perspective on the practicality, because as he gets more notoriety as a filmmaker and more money to his films, there's more control in being able to manipulate larger sets or places or areas. So I think that's just a really interesting thing. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's there you kind of see the seed of an artist, right? Like there you see, oh, he has a very specific vision of the way he wants to film something as he's able to build a larger canvas because of the resources he has at his disposal. He will continue to do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think another thread throughout that carries over in his films is, of course, like you said, the talking into the camera that he will employ to great effect. And sex, or at least sexuality, plays a massive role in most, if not all, of the films he's going to make from this point on.
Yeah. Showing the sexual relationship between characters in one way or another isn't something that he's shy about. And this is, I guess, jumping way ahead in his career. I'm curious if you saw the remake of She's Gotta Have It.
No, I haven't. Nothing beyond trailers.
Okay. So I did catch two or three of the episodes of it. It's actually remarkable how close it actually is.
Oh, is it really?
To the original.
Huh.
In some cases, just lifting dialogue and scenes directly from the original. Same characters, you know, there's a Nola Darling, there's a Mars Blackman, there's a Jamie Overstreet, and the performances are better. They got certainly better actors.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to see also the new Mars Blackman, who's played by a Latino actor, but I think I want to say represented as being of mixed race or biracial. It's interesting because, you know, he still gets across that sort of Mars Blackman sort of feel. All the characters have the same essence as the original, but
really?
But it's done over, I can't remember what it is, 6 or 8 episodes or something.
Okay.
So it's drawing the story out even more. It goes much further into, like, Nola's lesbian relationship with, you know, whoever it is. And
which is only implied in the film.
Right. And, but there's some scenes that are just, you know, straight up lifted
in
the new one, which was surprising to me for a couple of reasons. You don't expect an artist to go back to the stuff that he did as a kid, essentially,
right.
You know, like that. It just, and quite frankly, I was also surprised at how little he had developed that concept. And that sounds like an insult, but it was so true stylistically to exactly what he had done. I don't know how old Spike Lee was, you know, whatever, 22 or whatever, when he did the original. You could almost see him putting himself in the mindset of, I'm going to give a lot more money and a lot more production value to that kid and let that kid make this thing again. And there's some modern flourishes. They've got cell phones, and he gives titles to the scenes that all begin with hashtags and stuff like that. But yeah, it's basically the same. I don't know. It's really wild.
I mean, I'm curious to watch this show to see if he kind of develops any of these things that we judged or critiqued as immature.
Yeah.
I know one change he made, or toward the end of the film version of She's Gotta Have It, there's a rape scene.
Yeah.
Spike has been very vocal about that being his one regret.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker, that's not going to be, according to him, not going to be in the show.
It's an upsetting thing to have in the movie, honestly.
It's extremely upsetting, especially how it's dealt with, which he acknowledges as being stupid and making light of rape, right? Because it's vile, and then it's never dealt with.
Yeah, and ever, especially right? especially as an act perpetrated by a character who, up to that point, is supposed to kind of feel like a audience stand-in. And the level of respect that I had for the film went down in that scene.
Oh, absolutely. So this brings me to one of the questions that I'm really interested in asking you as somebody who's a working artist. To make art is a risky endeavor,
sure.
And you do things knowing that one day you're going to look back on them and wish that you did them differently.
Yeah.
There's kind of two questions in here that I've been thinking about. One is, what does it mean to evolve as an artist? Mm-hmm. The second is, how do you, or how do artists deal with the fact that you are going to make choices in the present that one day in the future you will regret?
Yeah.
I'm curious to know how you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bad analogy, but I think about when my wife and I were getting married. I'm the kind of person who appreciates things like color and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to have more input than probably most typical grooms want and you know, the planning and the look
your
of their wedding.
Directing your
kinda,
wedding.
Yeah. I was, you know, there were parts of it that I wanted to kind of art direct. So our whole planning process, I was a kid. I remember making the comment to her, I wanted to do a wedding that's going to embarrass us later.
That was your hope.
Yeah, I really genuinely wanted that because I remember seeing pictures of my own parents' wedding and, you know, they were in the 70s zoot suits and all that.
Right.
It was so silly. And, you know, you would see my parents just sort of hide their faces and shake their heads. Like, yeah, that's what we wore back then. And to me, that was so kind of right. You know, that was so sort of cool. It was stamping a moment in time. And yeah, I'm embarrassed now, and you know, but that's who we were then.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about that that's more remarkable than doing something that's, in some ways, than doing something that just feels so completely timeless and, oh, this is always going to be appreciated for what it is and in every day and age. And,
right.
You know, I think for a lot of artists, there is kind of a want to be like, you know, that wants to kind of, mm-hmm. buck against that, you know, that wants to be like, no, I need to get through a bunch of stuff that I know in advance. I don't know which things they are, but I know some of these things I'm going to regret.
Right.
And that's almost part of the romance of it. You have to have that kind of rebellious spirit of, you know, I don't know, fuck it, man. I want to say what I want to say. I want to do what I want to do. The fact that old guy me is going to be upset and offended, that's just another man that I feel like sticking it to.
Yeah.
I think I see some of that a little bit with Spike Lee, where he's just, you know, he's just got his middle fingers up to the world, including future Spike Lee,
yes.
And saying, you know, this is the way it is. You know, I think on a previous episode, we made the comment, you never in your life make the sort of art that you make when you're in your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Try as you might, you can't replicate that ever again. What a beautiful thing that is. So I don't know. Yeah, of course you're going to have regrets, and I'm sure Spike regrets that really, really bad scene. But what I hope he doesn't regret is at least the spirit that went into wanting to just do something anyway. And I realize that we're getting into like iffy territory there because we are talking about rape and all that. Clearly there's not an excuse, but I think the spirit that went into wanting to try something and risking it being awful and offensive, as much as it made me lose respect for the film, it didn't make me lose respect for the rebellious quality of Spike Lee as an artist. Is that weird?
I don't know. I don't think that's weird at all. I mean, I think that's one of the things we like to do on the Freshman 15 is say, what is something Spike Lee would do again? Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't do that again. I mean, he said no. That is his regret as an artist. Mm-hmm. But what he will continually do from that film onward is think of the question, what am I interested in right now? Mm-hmm. What's the story I want to tell today? And he will go for it. You know, with She's Gotta Have It, it's about a female character who is free with her sexuality and who wants independence. Yeah. And it's not perfect. Right. And he makes mistakes. You know, with Do the Right Thing, I want to make a film about racial tension. And by the end of it, I'm not going to tell anybody what they should think about this. Mm-hmm. It's just clear that everybody has their own prejudice and everybody is culpable mm-hmm. in what is going to end up happening. You know, with Malcolm X, I mean, you have this character, a strong black character who has a voice for the people, and all the way up to 25th Hour and its mm-hmm. allusions to 9/11, to Chirac and mm-hmm. gun violence. And here's a guy who's like, what do I think right now? Yeah. And I'm going to make a story that reflects that. You know, I'm in a job, and I don't know if many people know this, I'm a pastor, so I preach. Therefore, it's assumed that I have certain beliefs about things. What I think now, is that what I need to always think? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is that really what it means to have belief? Is that you have one thing that's set in time and will be forever? It seems like as a person, seems like as an artist, it seems like as just being a human being means mm-hmm. that you become a person who continues to live life and things inform one another. It's going to shift and it's going to change. And yeah. that's one of the things that I love about Spike Lee. Yeah. He's an artist who's committed to telling the story that he's interested in the moment he's telling it.
Yeah, I feel like you're talking about something that's way bigger than Spike Lee and maybe even way bigger than film. And maybe Spike Lee is helping us see this, which is maybe we need to be people who are okay with the fact that we're surrounded by people who are evolving. Mm. You say in your vocation, you're a minister. Mm-hmm. That particular vocation is something that your constituents, I'm not saying all of them, but classically, they have a hard time with the idea that you're evolving, you know?
Right.
Some of them might. A lot of them might. For me, that's actually an indictment of them more than it mm-hmm. is of you. I'm trying to be someone who looks at people around me, certainly with artists, but not just with artists, as people who are in process. Mm-hmm. That's why, if I'm being honest, you know, I know that right now, especially in the entertainment industry, there's a lot of, well, this person did this thing, or they behaved in a certain way, or they said a certain thing that we found out about, you know, from 10 years ago or something. And therefore, we need to make sure that they can't make art anymore.
Right.
I have a hard time with that. I really do. Because I realize this is a touchy topic, but there's so many things that people who have evolved from a bad place, I think, that have to say to us, you know? And I that's making it sound like I'm saying Spike Lee came from a bad place or something like
right.
that. I mean, yeah, maybe he made a lousy decision with this film. Is it gross to say there are positives to a bad filmmaking choice that he made that we can take something from, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, and it's not just with, you know, Rape and She's Gotta Have It, but, you know, I mean, and I'm not saying these are bad decisions, but, you know, I remember the experience of watching Malcolm X for the first time, mm-hmm. being mad that it didn't give me the closure that I wanted it to give me.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
I wanted to feel good as a white person about where we're heading,
yeah.
you know, and it wasn't letting me do that. There wasn't really a moment in there, not really, where it was saying, hey, white guy, I know that you're not like them. It's okay. Let's still come together. And Malcolm X didn't let me, it didn't give me that moment, you know?
Yeah.
I look back on it now and I'm like, I think I might have learned something much more important through Malcolm X than Spike Lee would have taught me otherwise if he had given me a nice, comfortable ending, or if he had given me maybe a less truthful account of the life of Malcolm X.
You're not an American. You're an African who happens to be an American. You have to understand the difference. We didn't come over on the Nita, the Pinta, and the whatchamacallit. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. Landed right on top of us.
But I don't know. I see that stuff all through his career. Maybe this is a failing of mine. Ultimately, Spike Lee probably isn't my kind of filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I don't gravitate toward him, mm-hmm. you know? It's not like a Kevin Smith thing or something like that where it's just like, well, I just think it's terrible and blah, blah, blah. No, it's not it. I just don't know. I don't know what it is. Maybe it is my own prejudices that I don't like talking about or something like that because, you know, maybe he's not speaking to people of my personality type and my ethnicity and my background and stuff. And maybe that's actually a good thing that he's not talking to people like me.
Right.
You know, I don't know, but this is what I wrestle with because I don't know. I don't feel myself wanting to run out and see a lot of Spike Lee movies though.
See, it's interesting. So I'm on the opposite end of that where I say that knowing or at least being aware of the fact that I haven't had a lot of opportunity or time to watch his more recent films. Mm. And that's probably being a little bit too generous to myself. I think that some of it has to do with interest, and I am interested in watching Chi-Raq and Red Hook's Summer. I'm not too interested in watching The Sweet Blood of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And those are just films I haven't got around to yet, but I'm certainly interested in.
Yeah.
Because Spike Lee, for whatever reason, does feel like my type of filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I think part of why that is, it's because I relate to wanting to kind of spark conversations, yeah. right? Even over and above craft. Like if I was to think about being a filmmaker, in contrast to you, my thinking about film doesn't begin with craft. Mm-hmm. Like when I watch a film, that's something I have to intentionally notice.
Yeah.
For me, watching a film is about, oh, wow, what is being communicated? What is being said? What are the ideas this kind of instigates in my mind? That's just how I read stories. That's how I watch films. And Spike Lee, so he hits all of those things for me, right? Yeah. I mean, that's like why I think he makes movies. I mean, he has craft and he's very stylized, but I do think that at the end of the movie, he just wants to get people talking.
Yeah. You know, when I hear you say that, I think maybe this is a qualifier. I would say that Spike Lee actually is my kind of filmmaker right up until I'm actually watching a Spike Lee movie, which is ridiculous. But, I don't like the fact that I can slide right into watching 25th Hour and Inside Man and love them and enjoy them. And then I get to She's Gotta Have It or... I don't know.
Jungle Fever.
Yeah, or Mo Better Blues or something like right. that. And I'm just like, I don't really know if I... And here's the thing, like yeah. Chi-Raq, I actually really enjoyed, but there were points in the movie that I'm just like, you know, I don't know. Am I going to finish this or not? And then I would be like, no, why wouldn't I? It's a great film. I'm really enjoying it. It's super creative. I really like just the lyrical quality to it and stuff like that. What is it? And I want the answer to be something so much more deep and intellectual than... I'm prejudiced. Mm-hmm. I'm worried that I am, though, you know? And
that's part of it.
That's part of it, and I hate it. I don't know what else to say. I hate that.
I think one of the things that Spike Lee does have, though, or at least that he recognizes, is that fact, right?
Yeah.
Is the fact that...
I gravitate towards watching people that look like me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he actually has grace for it. If he didn't have grace for it, he wouldn't have made a film like Do the Right Thing, where everybody is culpable. If he didn't have grace for that, he wouldn't have made... 25th Hour, which is one of the most profound scenes of Edward Norton looking into a mirror, saying, and I quote, fuck you, to all these different types and races of people.
Right.
Where at the end, he can't help but say, fuck you to himself.
Let the fires rage, let it burn to fucking ash, and then let the waters rise and submerge this whole rat-infested place. No, fuck you, Montgomery Brogan. You had it all and you threw it away, you dumb fuck!
That's where it begins and ends, right? All of this, whatever Spike Lee is attempting to say, begins and ends with a person
right.
who's part of a group of people
yeah.
and who think this way. And I think that's why I love him. You know, I love him as an artist, at least, what he gets people talking about.
Yeah. I want to have the maturity to love Spike Lee. And I'm not... quite there, and maturity is the wrong word, probably.
I think so, yeah.
But you know what? There is a part of me that there's a part of me that almost hears Spike Lee's voice in my head, and I hear him kind of saying, "I may not have made it for you, though, dude."
I think that's right.
I've got to be all right with that.
Yeah.
So She's Got to Have It. Interesting, difficult, immature, maybe in many ways, remarkable film. I mean, Spike Lee's made a lot of stuff, and so this is going to be an impossible question, but so I guess it's going to have to be, of the films that you've seen, what corner of the Spike Lee universe does She's Gotta Have It occupy?
You know, I'd probably place it between the bottom and the middle of the films that I've seen. I don't know. I think that there are a lot of things about it that are good. I think there are a lot of things about it he actually does better in other films. Mm. I would want people to see other Spike Lee films first before they see She's Gotta Have It.
Yeah. There's so much, and that's just pure, just, you know, just like acting craft. And I think if I'm allowing myself to be as honest as I would like to be, writing wise, even, I don't know that it's, I think it's still unformed.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize it got a lot of awards. I think people saw it and they saw there was a unique voice that it was important that we hear more from. But I think even at the time, probably the world could see that he needs some time.
Mm-hmm.
But if we let this guy marinate, he's going to be capable of incredible things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess the final question is, what do we think in general, recommendation wise? Should people see She's Gotta Have It, or are we saying completist?
I think this is a hard one to answer, but I'm going to answer it. Because Spike Lee has made so many films, and because he's made so many films, I think people should see. Mm. I'd say this is actually for completists only.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say?
Completist.
Yeah.
I don't think the quality is there, even if the spirit was.
Yes, I think that's a good, great way of putting it.
Yeah. So it's a good thing to go see some of these Spike Lee movies. I think I just remember sitting there in front of Chirac, maybe it was a year or year and a half ago, and just thinking, kind of cool that we have this guy, mm-hmm. you know? He's continuing to do things that other people would probably say are ill-advised. And, you know, I'm not always a big fan of the way Spike Lee movies are edited.
Yeah.
She's Gotta Have It as a perfect example. But, you know, even some of his more recent movies, but it makes me kind of pay attention to the craft. And maybe that's not always a good thing, but I don't mind sometimes doing that. And Spike Lee is someone who, yeah, he takes me out of it, but he takes me out of it sometimes in a good way.
If there were any listeners who's not really seen any early Spike Lee, I'd say the place to start, no doubt, is Do the Right Thing.
I would agree with that.
I think if you were to start with Do the Right Thing and kind of work your way to the present, I actually think it would make a viewing of She's Gotta Have It better than if you started there. You see this artist who's, I think, by Do the Right Thing, that's the film, right? I feel like he was created to make.
Mm.
But you can go back and say, oh, okay, I can see where this might fit.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this has been an experience.
How was the deal? I think we made a deal and we kept to it.
Yeah, I think fairly well. She's got to have it. At the end of the day, I don't think Daniel and I are going so far as to recommend the film. But if you want to get into one of these Uber discussions, maybe check out other Spike Lee films before this one. But, you know, as you can see, there's a lot here to provoke. So Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It.
But seriously, we'd love to hear what you think about this film or about other films you'd like to hear us discuss. freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook or Instagram. Also, if you haven't had a chance to rate us on iTunes, please go ahead and do that. It helps people find us so that they can be part of the larger conversation as well.
And no surprise by now, you know, we couldn't end an episode without bringing up our profound affection for the streaming service known as Filmstruck that we subscribe to. I love Filmstruck. Daniel.
Love it.
As a half/mostly white guy, although, you know, I'm about as WASPy as they get. But just so you can be part of that art elite conversation that you know that you really want to be a part of between us and other white or partly white people. Filmstruck subscription. You're just not going to go wrong. Be smart and important like we are.
There's something for every one of me.
That's right. Before we go, so we're getting ready to head into the summer months. And
ooh.
I think there's a rumor, Daniel, we might be rolling out something a little special for those summer months coming up.
You want to tell them?
Yeah, well, let's just say that we're going to try something sort of interesting in these lazy, hazy summer months. So stay tuned
to
the Freshman 15.
Can't wait.
We're going to have something special coming for the next little while. Once again, thanks so much for joining us. Till next time. next time, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
We'll talk to you next time.
Goodbye.